wish you were here.
WIOX is supported by the following community underwriters.
The Fierce Grizzly, a Roxbury eatery on the corner of Vega Mountain Road and Main Street, serving breakfast and lunch 6 days a week and dinner on Friday and Saturday evenings. Closed Thursdays. Reservations suggested 845-901-2351. 845-901-2351. Or thefiercegrizzly.com.
Catskill Mountain Cleaning, specializing in Airbnbs, vacation homes, and private residences. Cleaning, firewood stack, trash removal, and small pest exterminating. Serving the Catskills region, including Margaretville, Andes, Bovina, and the surrounding area. More information at 607-261-1674 or catskillmountaincleaning.com. 1053 Main Street Gallery in Fleischmann's, designed as a space to support a vibrant and active artistic community nestled within the Catskill Mountains. 1053 Main Street Gallery presents Alone, a solo exhibition of paintings by contemporary American realist Lisbeth Furman, using images of abandoned houses to explore the relationship between people and their environment. On view through Sunday, December 19th. Information at 1053maingallery.com. The Arc Bowl and Barbecue, Route 28 in Arkville, New York. A 120-seat, restored 1960s-era vintage 8-lane bowling alley, barbecue joint, saloon, and music entertainment venue. Featuring a slow, smoked and grilled barbecue menu. The Arc Bowl and Barbecue, available for all types of social events, including weddings, birthday parties, and work gatherings. Details at thearcbowl.com.
Hi, this is Susan Shaw.
And I'm Alan Vella.
We go to New Orleans on All That Gumbo every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6.
And you are listening to WIOX Roxbury.
Live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and at 107.5 FM on the campuses of SUNY Delhi on smart devices through the Radio FM app and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
I'm fine, Ryan. How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting into winter here. December 1st.
Yeah.
Firing up the wood stove.
Woodpile starting to show a difference now after we've hit December.
Yeah, you probably see mine. There's a big dent in it.
Yeah. Yeah, mine's getting there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt. But my wife is cold-blooded, and the house is 80 degrees, so.
I know. I'm getting used to it. Back when I had another house that it was terribly insulated and the wood stove sucked, and my house wouldn't get above like 65 degrees ever.
Yeah.
And you would tell me that your house is 80, and I didn't think I could ever live in 80, but I'm there. When I light the wood stove in the evening, it's up there. By the time we go to bed, it's 80, 83 sometimes, but the bedrooms are cooler.
Yeah, I walk around in shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah, me too.
So, I think I've earned it.
So what'd you see in the
I'm
woods?
I'm entitled.
You're entitled.
to walk around. I'm a wood-burning, entitled, you know, person where I can walk around with a shorts and a t-shirt.
In the winter months.
That's right.
Yeah, I know. My wife thinks it's funny when I walk outside with my shorts and a t-shirt on to go, I don't know, run to the truck or whatever, take the trash out to the garage.
Oh, yeah.
She thinks it's hilarious.
I do it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, your core temperature is so high at that point, you know. So, what were you going to say?
Well, I saw a bobcat in the woods the other day.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know if I could say I stalked him, but I walked up on him after following his tracks for more than 100 yards, maybe 200. He was just heading the same direction I was, and I decided to follow his tracks, and eventually there he was.
No kidding.
He had no idea I was there.
Huh.
He was just doing his thing, hunting.
That's odd.
Very. I've seen flashes of them in the woods before, and I've seen them crossing roads in front of me, but I've never got to watch one do its thing.
Yeah, me neither. So how about that?
Yeah, how about that?
Well, all right. This is going to be a long show.
All right. Strap in.
So it's kind of a controversial thing, but amongst people who manage wildlife. But here it goes. The myth, tonight's topic is the myth of market hunting boogeyman. How about that, John?
I laughed when I saw boogeyman in the title.
Yeah. You know, I just have to do this because, you know, I used to feel the opposite of this, but after researching it for quite a while, I've come to this hypothesis, maybe conclusion. But anyway, let's define, what is a myth? A myth is a popular belief or story that has become associated with a person, institution, or occurrence, especially one considered to illustrate a cultural ideal. Right? Usually in myths, you're going to have like a hero and a villain. I feel like this is true of a lot of American stories.
Yeah.
You have a good guy and a bad guy.
Every action movie.
You're either for us or you're against us. Right?
Yeah. You're...
I mean, there was another movie that had three sides of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But that was made by an Italian guy, so what does he know about America? Right? Gotta have two. Sure. Anyway, spaghetti western. So basically what we're going to talk about a little bit is the North American model for wildlife conservation and how it comes into this myth I'm going to talk about. And you know, I'm saying myth kind of in a funny way. I mean, I'm not saying it's all false, but it's really just to, you know, raise some attention surrounding this. But anyway, there's a North American model for wildlife conservation, and it's not a legislative thing, the North American model. It's just like a guideline that our state agencies, wildlife agencies, follow in wildlife management. There's nothing in the Constitution or anything about it.
Right.
So, basically, there's seven basic tenets. One is that, and the first two is really what we're going to focus on tonight, but I'll read them all in case you're unfamiliar with this. Wildlife resources are held in public trust, right? So no one owns the deer. The people of the state of New York own the deer, right? Really, the United States of America owns it, and then I think through the 10th Amendment, it's given to the states to manage. But I could have that wrong. Anyway, the second is markets for game are eliminated. So, or I would say today they're not eliminated. They're mainly reduced. Third is wildlife use is allocated by laws and regulations. Four, wildlife can be killed only for legitimate purposes. It's pretty subjective. Five, wildlife is considered an international resource. Well, that's probably true with migratory bird species, right, John?
Yeah.
Six, science is proper tool to develop wildlife species policies. And 7, democracy of hunting is standard. Everyone has an opportunity.
So this is directly opposed to the European model, right? The king owns or the queen owns all of the wildlife on the land. It is the king's deer.
Well, it's funny you say that. I mean, maybe Britain, I don't know. But we've had Tom Eberlein from University of Wisconsin on. Sweden is in Europe, and the king doesn't own it. The biologists there, the state biologists, control the numbers still. But once that animal is on your property and you kill it, you own it and you can sell it. You can't do that in the United States.
Right.
So, yeah. Now, maybe if the king owns it, that's different. You know, I don't know. To me, it gets pretty gray. I mean, if people say they own it in trust, and I always say, well, what does that mean? Well, that means the people own it. Well, the government then. The government owns it. So that's like the king. I mean, in democracy of hunting, did you vote on the Hunter Orange thing?
No.
No. So where's the democracy? Anyway, they just put it up to public comment, and then I never saw it come to a vote that hunters had to wear orange. I never saw that, did you?
No, didn't happen.
Anyway, I digress because it's been year after year, it's safety. It's been one of the safest seasons ever, and they still change it to Hunter Orange. You have to wear it.
And it's funny you say that because, I mean, the seventh tenet you just mentioned is democracy of hunting is standard. It's
so I'm saying.
Do you hear the big uproar in the legislative in Colorado to reintroduce wolves, right? It was a ballot box initiative, right?
Yeah.
And pretty much the whole outdoor industry that I listened to was all in arms about that. You can't do that at the ballot box. We need science behind this, that was the argument.
It's a good point. So it looks like there's two tenets that are at odds with each other.
Right, exactly.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, this model is kind of weird the more you look into it, isn't it? The hero of this model, the North American model for conservation, is, I would say, the progressive movement of the early 20th century, the progressive conservation movement, Teddy Roosevelt, not Franklin, Teddy, and the father of forestry, Gifford Pinchot. So Roosevelt believed open markets in logging and hunting were greatly exploiting natural resources and must be preserved by divorcing scarce resources from market forces. And that's what we're going to focus on, the first two tenets of the North American model for wildlife conservation, again, which are wildlife resources are held in public trust, so everyone owns them essentially, and 2, markets for game are eliminated. So is that clear so far?
Yeah.
All right. The villain, the bad guy of this myth is the greedy hunter or logger. To this day, loggers, I mean, you know, there's a lot of cartoons of loggers out there. I can think of one. The Onceler. Dr. Seuss, man.
Oh, Dr. Seuss. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Dr. Seuss's Onceler. There's a lot of, I don't know, Disney things portraying the big bad hunter. Especially one, I don't know, my kids had some cartoon on the other day. It shows a bunch of loggers smoking cigarettes inside this hut, dragging bears into the lodge and they're counting stacks of money. You know, it's just like, what is this?
Oh, man.
But it's
not true.
Anyway, you know, I'm not going to say it hasn't happened. There's bad things with anything. So anyway, the conservationist, the progressive conservationist, believe that in market failure. That's where this comes from, that there's market failure is when social costs are higher than private output or private gain. So that would be a market failure, right? Does that make sense?
You got to give me a better example.
Like someone has a business and they're making money on it, yet it's at the cost of society.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure it's happened. It's definitely happened. We're going to go into why that can happen. Anyway, so the DNRs in each state, which are the Department of Natural Resources, and in our case would be Department of Environmental Conservation, reinforce this paradigm. To this day, if you go into magazines or hunting journals, hunters and non-hunters both believe market hunting is what killed wildlife.
It's always listed first. Market hunting. And habitat loss.
And then habitat loss.
It's never habitat loss first.
Usually not. And then this I'm not going to really get too much outside of that, but I'm going to challenge that. So private ownership of wildlife is not allowed. However, gradually, wildlife rebounds in the mid-20th century further reinforcing the paradigm of the progressive conservationists that, hey, you know, our North America model worked, right? We got rid of markets. We own public and we own wildlife and trust. And they came back, right? Makes sense. It worked. It instilled game laws. So you would think that this was successful. New York State went from paying bounties for killing bears in 1894 and then in 1903 protecting the same black bears. Isn't that amazing? I mean, this is a huge shift. 1894, 1903. They're paying bounties in the Adirondacks and whatnot for killing bears. 1903, they're protecting them. Eventually, the bears would be found throughout the state. Another win for the conservationists, right? Hey, I've read this when I was in college and stuff and been like, this movement was highly successful. And I'm not saying that they didn't have successful things about it. I'm just saying there's another side to it, and I think that's what we'll get to. So the hypothesis is that the above might be exaggerated, that it exaggerates the ills of market forces, and it undervalues wildlife habitat or forest regrowth. So like many myths, there is some truth. There's some truth. I mean, did game laws help? Did reducing the killing of or harvesting of does help deer populations rebound?
Yeah, as long as people follow the rules.
Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be your biggest driver for population growth or decline is if, you know, we were always taught in wildlife management class that the males in any population don't matter because in theory, one male could populate all of the does.
Right.
All of them.
Okay. I get it.
All of them.
I got you.
Which, you know, that's not going to happen, but...
I don't know. I mean, those bucks are busy, man.
Yeah, I know. You see him running around the last 3 weeks?
Oh, yeah, I did, actually. So, market hunting has been around for a long time. And market hunting is just basically the voluntary exchange of goods and services and someone profiting, whether it's glass beads or dollars. Someone is personally gaining or tribally gaining, whatever, through the selling of wildlife resources. So Native Americans traded a lot. They owned property, not individually, but apparently through tribes. A lot of this information I'm getting is from Dean Lewix, who is a professor. I forget where it's at. But anyway, I'm referring to a lot of his studies, though. But anyway, market forces had a large impact on wildlife resources. I'm not saying they didn't. For instance, high prices fetched for beaver skins, which were made into felt hats, in the 17th and 18th centuries, definitely incentivized trapping.
Yeah, I mean there was whole expeditions.
Yeah,
you know, common expeditions known of up and down river systems for beavers.
Yep, absolutely. So, but the other side of this is forests, right? And forests to farms and back again to forests. So yes, wildlife populations reached their lowest point in the 19th to early 20th centuries, right? Late 1800s, mm-hmm. early 1900s. We've talked about that many times.
Yep. New York was thought to be over two-thirds cleared at that time.
It's amazing. You know, if you ever get a chance, go to the Mohonk Mountain House in Ulster County near New Paltz, and they have old photos showing the view that you're looking at over the Rondout Valley, looking towards the Catskill Mountains, Shokan High Point and whatnot, across the Shokan Basin. And there's no trees in those photos. You can see literally where the Rondout is or the Metacons or whatever those small streams are, Mumbakas Creek, by the ribbon of trees on their edge. And that's it.
Hmm.
It's amazing. It really is. You know, now it's completely forested. So the absence of many of North America's well-known wildlife plummet in the late 1800s as land is cleared for agriculture, fisher, coyote, turkey, bear, mountain lion, elk, etc. Some relocation programs were successful, as well as game laws, which, as I said before, reinforced the progressive conservation movement. So, but we got to talk about this clearing thing. For agriculture. I mean, this is a huge deal, right? So let's just look at the name wildlife, for example. I mean, did you ever think about why it's called wildlife?
Because it's not in a pasture field?
Yeah, absolutely. The opposite of wild is domestic. It was domesticated livestock that took the place of wildlife, and hence the designation of the other life, or wild life. It just, it was not normal. It wasn't something sought after. So historical clearing of forest and wildlife in the Northeast. This, what I mean by historical, this is insane. I mean, this is probably the one of the biggest things that happened in the environment since the glaciers receded, you know? I mean, you have, what'd you say, two-thirds of the forest is cleared?
Yeah, of New York State.
Yeah. And then by the late 1800s, it peaks. Early 20th century, it's only like 1910s, 20s, it starts growing back. And this is well documented. I mean, there's, we have photos of this and everything. I mean, we know what happened.
Yeah, and now it's completely reversed. We're over two-thirds forested.
It's amazing.
In New York State.
And it's so underappreciated. It just boggles my mind. So, few remaining forests offering habitat for wildlife. Right? So you think about it. It's 1898. You're in Delaware County. And if you were to say to a dairy farmer then, hey, guess what, pal? This is gonna mess with you. And you get out your crystal ball in front of him, right? And you say, Mr. McNaught, not only is your farm going to be gone by 1970, but it'll all be forested. What do you think he would do? Probably,
no way.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way, right? Are you crazy, pal?
Right, not after all this work.
You know, we're in Bovina.
Right.
We're in Roxbury, you know? This place is cow country. It's not going to happen, right? So what I'm hypothesizing is that market hunting was only successful after the land was cleared because, as a hunter, now we've had market hunting since the founding, the 1600s, and the Native Americans had trade. They finally clear the forest. Where are you going to go as a market hunter?
To the little patch of woods that's left.
Absolutely. It becomes a little fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
If they're even there at that point, right?
Yeah.
I mean, average maximum pasture is, what, 2,700 feet, according to Dr. Michael Kudish?
Yeah, I agree with that.
So you're going to hone in on those areas.
Right. I read an excerpt off of, this came off the Bovina Historical Society's website, I believe.
Yeah.
I was pawing through their website one day and reading articles and found this paragraph. They described such and such farm killing a nuisance bear, right? To the amount of description it led to was, we went to so and so's farm, found his woodlot, and five men surrounded the woodlot and killed the bear.
Amazing.
That's how easy it was. Today it's like, all right, go find a bear.
It could be anywhere.
Good luck.
I know.
Good luck.
And there are places in Dutchess County where I've been on landowner's property, and like, this particular ridge was used by the local farms solely for firewood, because Dutchess County was cleared, completely cleared, just about. You know what I mean?
Some of the rockiest, hilliest slopes were left, and some of
some
trees grew, and that's where the firewood was taken.
Yeah, absolutely. So I believe that the primary stressor, the hypothesis here, is habitat loss. Clearing for agriculture. It's not cutting for timber. They didn't cut enough for timber. I mean, they didn't have enough things to build from this timber. It was clearing, or you actually got burned the wood. And in many cases, it was sold as charcoal back to Europe. The secondary stressor, in my mind, is the lack of property rights mixed with market forces. And I'm going to talk more about that. But market hunting can only have an ill impact most of the time if there's no property rights. I'll just briefly say this. John, if there was, and every hunter has thought about this, if you saw an 8-pointer that's owned in common, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't shoot it, what will happen?
It's going to walk over that property line and your neighbor's going to shoot it.
All right, so that's an open access problem. So we're going to talk more about that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is the myth of the market hunting boogeyman.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from a bottomless pit. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs. All I ever had,
redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.
Okay, that's Johnny Cash. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talking about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is the myth of the market-hunting boogeyman. The hypothesis here is the primary stressor that reduced wildlife populations in the late 19th century was habitat loss, or the forest clearing for agriculture. Secondary stressor, lack of property rights mixed with market forces. So, we have this vast farm abandonment that starts to occur in the early 20th century. And I would say it was phenomenal. 100 years of farm abandonment that's been going on since 1920s, essentially. The wildlife species directly follow forest succession. All right? So this might, many of you listening out there might hear this and say, yeah, that makes sense. So think about your grandfather. Most people's grandfathers. My grandfather was born in 1921. Not a hunter. There's nothing to hunt, really. All right. It's in Highland in Ulster County. It's mainly cleared for orchards and other agriculture. It's cleared big time. All right. Now, my father, born in the 50s, like many people's parents then, are mostly small game hunters. Yeah. And their rifles reflect that. Right?
Yep.
Calibers and stuff.
Our camp started in the 50s, and there's records of every deer shot, and it was so common, 35 Remington, 300 Savage, 30-30, all these calibers that are considered today as the brush guns.
Brush guns.
They're put into that bubble as the brush guns.
Good point. Brush guns. That means the this early successional growth is starting to explode by the between the 20s and 50s, generally speaking. Right? Grouse hunting.
Yeah.
Rabbit hunting. Woodcock. Maybe quail in some other areas. Who knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pheasant, if you're down south. All that good stuff. All right. Then deer hunting's starting to begin. And where does it begin? In the areas that either were never cleared or experienced farm abandonment really a long time ago, like mm-hmm. the, you know, 1880s or where your hunting club is,
right.
High up in the elevation, the old so-called hill farms.
Right.
A lot of those hunting clubs started in rocky areas of Sullivan County, like Forestburg, Lumberland, in Hardinburg, Ulster County, Denning, really rugged country. That's where the first hunting clubs are. Mm-hmm. That's the only place where deer are.
Right. And people would travel from central Delaware County and beyond.
Right.
In the western part of the Catskills into these interior spots. And that's where their
right.
game was.
So people born in the 40s to the 60s starting to be deer hunters. I'm born in 1981. Deer population peaks in the 1990s in the Wallkill Valley of Ulster County. I've been looking at the data, and it reflects that. I'm a deer hunter. There's just tons of deer. I got spoiled. You go out in Gardner or New Paltz, just 10, 20, 30 deer. It's great. It's a mecca. It's awesome. Fast forward to someone born in 2017, like my son. He might be a bear hunter.
He might be. And good for him.
The forest has matured now. There's less early successional growth. Bears don't have stepladders, but they can climb trees. Deer can't. And the forest is maturing. A lot of our early successional species have gone down. No one's really a grouse hunter or a small game hunter in any significant way like they used to be. It's really hard to find those areas,
mm-hmm.
unless it's some kind of private preserve or something. So, I mean, that makes sense. I feel like that's pretty accurate for a lot of areas.
Yeah, you know? I mean, the timing might advance or go backwards 20 years here and there, but that's the trend.
Yeah. Author Jim Sterba, it's a good book called Nature Wars. He talks about this direct correlation between forest decline, wildlife species plummet. Forest regrowth, wildlife species come back up. Do I think game laws had a significant, a positive impact on wildlife? Yes. I just don't think they were nearly as significant as the accidental farm abandonment across the eastern United States of America.
Yeah.
It's a boring story. But someone's got to take credit for it. And I think it was the progressive conservation movement. I think they took credit for it. I think they should take some credit. But, man, that farm abandonment.
You know, and even in the rural community, that I feel pays attention to that. Like a farm family, right? The grandfather can sit there and tell the grandkids about, oh, all these pastures up here that are now our woodlots. I used to hay there, right? But there's always this gap of the trend of game, because he also is the same person that says, well, I don't see any rabbits anymore, but we do have more coyotes these days.
Yeah.
There's no – that never seems to come together in the conversation. Well, why
the habitat
were you, why
and the wildlife?
Why were you seeing the rabbits? Because it was a brushy, abandoning pasture at the time.
Hey, it's a great point. The first time – I guess the first time I really started to think about this in relation to how the – DEC manages wildlife, now that you made me think about it, made me kind of skeptical of this whole market hunting, get me thinking about the bigger picture, was in Oneonta. The DEC, Jeremy Hurst, he's the deer biologist for the state of New York.
Yeah, maybe big game, but
big game.
Either way, deer, yeah.
Well, talking about deer. And they already, you can't ask them a direct question. You have to put it on a piece of paper, and then they read it, right? And my question was, how do you manage deer numbers when the habitat is constantly changing? He just said, good question. This is a great question. But I can't really answer it. And it's true. I mean, because they really have citizen task force, and they just, you know, they put their finger up in the air and say, well, do you think the population is too small or big? And that's about it. Either we keep it the same, lower it, or increase it. And but the habitat's always changing. So what you said is completely true in wildlife management. For some reason, the habitat has been divorced from managing wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really strange, weird thing, you know?
The only time it really comes into play is when numbers dwindle so low where we talk nothing about the habitat when we want to preserve everything, right? Maybe an animal is on the endangered species list.
Right.
And that's when habitat is discussed and becomes important. It becomes a land grab at that point. And
if you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
Look at rattlesnakes. They'll protect the den. And they'll say, oh, timber rattlesnakes, they're rare across the state. Well, that's because their habitat's going away. You're not burning anymore, so you have less rattlesnake habitat. But where some places, rattlesnake's abundant. It's common on the Shawangunk Ridge. It's common up there. But they have a legacy of fire. So, I mean, if you're lucky. That New England cottontail that doesn't cross the Hudson River for some reason. Right, they're talking about habitat with that, right?
Yeah.
Trying to get
young forest. Trying to manage for that and cut more forest, yeah.
So I know what you're thinking. Cows, they, you know, basically, well, let me back up. Habitat's important to wildlife, just as pasture is the cows. But what you might be thinking after that is, well, cows are brought to slaughter, right? And markets are the metaphorical slaughterhouse for wildlife. That's what we think of, a lot of us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to slaughter wildlife, put them up to the market. Well, let's explore that, right? If you're just tuning in to listen to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., tonight's topic is the myth of the market hunting boogeyman. All right, so, yeah, markets can be a very good incentive for reducing numbers, no?
Could be, yeah.
Could be, right? But, so let's go into a few examples here. Inland and maritime fisheries. Well, we've heard how oceans have been overexploited for their fishing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Inland fisheries like rivers and streams, same thing. So did the markets incentivize their overuse? Well, I would say yeah. I mean, if you're in the ocean and you don't catch the cod, remember that buck we were talking about before? Someone else will. Right?
Right.
If you don't catch it, someone else will, especially in international waters. I mean.
So if your business survives on that income, then you have to go catch it.
Yeah. So according to Professor Dean Lewis, this is his equation, private markets plus open access equals disaster. Right? So if you have a fish like a cod or it's, say, brook trout are going for a lot of money, and no one owns the stream or no one can protect the stream is another way to say it, if you don't like the word ownership. It's open access, in other words. It's going to equal disaster because it creates a race, right? If you don't catch the fish, someone else will, you know? So beavers located in a swamp with open access, fetching good prices for felt hats back in the 17th century, it creates a race. Now, what he found in his study was as the prices started to increase, property rights were established. Beavers are much more easier than deer to contain. People would buy up the land and say, stay away, pal. These things are worth money. It's an investment now.
This swamp is mine.
Right. That's why beavers were never extirpated. The people started to protect them. When Native Americans, European settlers, they started to protect them. So with property rights, they start to form and protect resources as prices rise. The example is with timber. We never ran out of timber, even in the most agricultural increases in the United States. Timber never ran out, and it's because of prices. As this is what Dean Lewis found, it was solid property rights surrounding timber. As stocks dwindled, prices increased, and landowners sought to protect their resource from trespassers. For example, International Paper, he goes into, had 100-year management plans.
Whoa.
Jim Waters, former executive director of Catskill Forest Association, told me about this. He worked for some of these companies like Champion International. 100-year management plans. The only reason why they sold their land is taxes increased too much. Taxes started to treat their land as a liability. And what do you do with liabilities? You expunge liabilities. But if those taxes weren't so high, which I think was a big mistake by the government to raise property taxes, and it's still a bad thing on forest resources, they were managing for that long. Once the taxes went up a certain amount, they sold to TIMOs, Timber Investment Management, whatever the hell they are.
Once the taxes outgrew the timber.
Yeah, or they sold to the state of New York. But and most of them went south. South has much less taxes. So there's another example in ocean fisheries, and the ocean is open access for the most part. But I guess there's been some places like in Iceland where they've established fishing rights that can be transferred. So now instead of, if I don't catch it, someone else will. If I have fishing rights over a certain designated area, why would you deplete the resource?
Right.
You'd be like taking a sledgehammer to your window when you get home tonight. Why are you going to do that?
Let's let that small fish go so we can go catch that big fish later.
It seems to be working, I hear. You know, it's the same thing that barbed wire did with cows. When the West was wild, people's pastures were reduced to mud. Once barbed wire and property rights started to become established, now they could conserve their pasture land. Well, I don't want to ruin my own pasture. Whoa, let's do some conservation here. Keep your cows off of my land, and I'll keep them on mine, and I want to grow my asset. And that's what started happening with cows. Now, wildlife's going to be a little different. So the example is with buffalo. And Dean Lewis has, wrote a paper called Extermination and Conservation of the American Bison. Bison, to me, is like the poster child or poster animal of market hunting, being the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think of Dances with Wolves and Kevin Costner marching around looking at skinned buffalo, right, and being like, look at what these hide hunters did. And they did. Hide hunters destroyed buffalo. But why? So he goes into several reasons. One was, first of all, Native Americans did have property rights over buffalo. It was more tribal, not individuals, but they wanted to protect the resource from neighboring tribes, according to him. However, there's another reason why the bison was reduced greatly. New techniques in hide tanning, right? So during the late 1800s, they're getting better and better at tanning leather into hides. There's also reduced cost of harvesting. Rifles. Rifling is just starting to come into play. Horses. Native Americans didn't have horses. So now you have horses that you can actually run and gun after the buffalo. Rails. Rails are punching through the Midwest. Now they can get them to market faster.
Transport them, yeah.
Yeah. But the biggest thing he says is the buffalo were vulnerable, especially as the Native Americans started to die away, to open access. No one on them. There was a race to kill these animals. And Lewis claims that how you know open access is occurring when there's a lot of waste. So four buffalo, he claimed, were being laid waste to one recovered for their hide. Hence Kevin Costner seeing a bunch of them just laying there, right?
Amazing.
In the movie, Dances with Wolves, I'm referring to. The carrying capacity of the Midwest buffalo before all this reduction occurred, he claims, was 14 to 21 million. This is in the Midwest, in the primal area of buffalo. 14 to 21 million. And it was reduced to 2 to 3 million by the late 1800s as water and grass was allocated to cows.
So not only were they reduced, they were replaced.
This is probably the most significant thing. 1890. Right, remember this number, 14 to 21 million is the carrying capacity for buffalo, right?
Mm-hmm.
By 1890, there's 36.8 million cows in the same area.
Wow.
The cow replaced the buffalo.
two and a half times.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Who would think, right? So unlike beavers that never were eliminated, since they were subject to price decreases and increases, the buffalo hide prices remain the same, he says. Which is weird. And the reason why it remained the same, despite stocks increasing or decreasing, was because it was a substitute cow leather. Cow leather was so similar that it didn't matter.
Huh.
It was a replacement. So in summary, according to Lewis, bison were eliminated due to habitat replacement by agriculture. The lack of private property rights, technological improvements, rifle, horse, which reduced the cost of killing bison, and the lack of competition with cowhides, which made for stable prices. A quote that I think is pretty important that he says is, wealth maximizing individuals tend to overuse resources held in common. The bison, to me, is a perfect example of this. So actually, ironically, the people who brought back bison were ranchers. Some guys just really liked bison. And in the 1890s, they were starting to protect bison. They didn't want them to go away. And they started, it's not propagating when you're propagating an animal. What would that be called, John?
When you're, what do you mean? Stalking?
No. Yeah, but they started breeding them. Breeding them?
Yeah, captive breeding, I
guess. Yeah, captive breeding them. Almost all the of the herd today's wild herd traces back to these ranchers who bred those bison. And the weird thing is that bison is the only wild animal that's considered livestock in many states of the Midwest. So you can protect it more easily.
Hmm.
But so if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., and tonight's topic is the myth of the market hunting boogeyman. It's just a little hypothesis that we think that, or I think, I don't know what John feels, he's got his own brain, that the primary stressor was habitat loss that was responsible for most wildlife being reduced. That's clearing for agriculture, wildlife being replaced by livestock. Secondary stressor is market hunting when there is no private property rights in place. So the myth revisited, the myth of the greedy market hunter mowing down wildlife only to be saved by the Cape Crusading game species is partly true. I do think there was some good things, those relocation programs. The Fisher has had a relocation program, I think, in the 1980s.
Fisher, wild turkey, elk, they all have.
But a lot of them failed until the habitat. I mean, the turkey, they tried for a long time, and it failed.
Yeah.
Deer, there was a lot of – they didn't really understand it. Like you were saying how habitat was divorced from wildlife for many years and still to this day. Frost Valley, I think, had pens. There's still – I've seen the fencing in mm-hmm. the woods where they had – deer or elk. And they just thought, hey, if we just get these animals, they'll grow, they'll be fine. They're wild animals. No. They didn't have the habitat, they died. So you can't do that. Turkey, same thing. It wasn't until the habitat was there, then you could do the relocation programs. Fisher have habitat now. Fishers are going to spread. These wildlife are spreading whether we want them or not now. Hence yeah. the book, Jim Sterba's book, Nature Wars. I mean, that's what his whole book's about, you know?
Right. It's when the carrying capacity of wildlife is exceeding the social carrying capacity of humans.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just not that exciting of a story. We like heroes, and the hero is the progressive conservationist Teddy Roosevelt walking around with his big stick, and Gifford Pinchot, father of forestry. And I think a lot of this was just more accidental. I think some of it was planned, but a lot of it was just accidental. It was just wildlife being replaced by livestock, and then the abandonment of forest, and then wildlife coming back, resurging. So it was given the technology in the late 1800s. We take it for granted today, but the forest had to be cleared to feed literal horse and oxen power for food for a growing nation. And technology has improved. We don't have to rely upon horsepower, oxen, to move stones and make aqueducts and canals like the D&H Canal. You imagine doing right. that by hand?
Now we have hundreds of horsepowers in one engine.
It's amazing. Yeah. Look at your cell phone. You know? It's crazy. Technology. So, conclusion, instead of demonizing the market hunting from the 1800s. This is from the 1800s. We're judging market hunting, which comes in many shapes and sizes, from the 1800s. We could use it as an opportunity. And this is why we're going to have Paul Curtis on. He's going to talk about both the benefits and the cost of market hunting. We're going to talk about more of this, I think, in January. I forget. But to be aware of the impacts of open access, I think this just does not get publicized enough. Open access is where you run into problems. When no one's responsible for the wildlife, something bad's going to happen. Besides, market hunting is already allowed. You're allowed to sell fur-bearing species, right?
Yeah, this is one of the things that popped out in your original tenets that you read about the North American wildlife. Sure, you can sell the gallbladder out of a bear. You can sell pelts of fur-bearing animals. You could sell antlers from a deer.
Yeah.
You can't sell the meat from a deer. That's a no-no.
You can't sell the meat from any wild animal. They do in Sweden. They have no problems maintaining their moose and all the game species they have there, whatever deer they have. Red deer? I don't know what it is.
Moose, right?
They also have a deer.
Yeah. Red stags, then?
Red stag. So the sale of wild meat is prohibited under the North American model for wildlife conservation. But by providing a market where someone is incentivized to do so, this could especially be profitable and helpful in areas of suburban areas where hunters don't want to hunt and deer population should be reduced. So that's it's an opportunity for ecological reasons. Currently, over 85% of venison eaten at restaurants in the United States is imported from New Zealand. It's crazy. Be like importing firewood to Delaware County. That's silly. I don't know.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things around that, too, with our USDA slaughterhouse laws that we can't get around right now.
Totally. So David Drake talked about from the University of Wisconsin when he was talking about commercial harvesting as an opportunity and got almost, if he may have even gotten ousted from the Wildlife Society. But, yeah, he said the biggest hurdle is the USDA, giving that stamp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're doing it in Texas, though.
Oh, yeah?
Because there's what the heck is the deer there? I want to say Sika deer.
Yeah.
So that was released. Everything's released in Texas, right? They've got all sorts of exotic wildlife. And because it's not considered it's considered an invasive species, right? I've listened to a podcast recently of a restaurant owner who has a team of hunters that goes out, collects for the restaurant, and they bring a USDA agent with them. And they harvest these deer in the field and serve them in his restaurant. So
that's excellent.
It is possible. Someone's doing it. He does it with hogs, too, with feral pigs.
And you could still have the state biologist monitor numbers.
So maybe we're going somewhere.
You know, yeah, absolutely you could do that. Here's the thing, too. Even if you had a full-blown market on deer, let's just say, look how diverse the property ownership is across Delaware County.
Access would be the hardest.
It doesn't matter if you had full-blown market. There's going to be landowners, many of them are like, you can't hunt on my property. Boom, refuge.
Right.
It's just it was so homogenous in the private ownership in the 1800s. Almost everyone was in agriculture. Today, that's not true. There's so many different landowners. I just can't see it being a problem, but maybe I'm wrong. Lastly, forest owners should be incentivized to improve wildlife habitat for forest quality, since we know that habitat is paramount, or at least that's what we've talked about tonight. In order to do this, forest owners should not be penalized for owning forests. So taxes, as I said before, International Paper Company had 100-year management plans. They only unleashed their properties when taxes went up. You know, things that get taxed are things you get less of. You want to liquidate those things. So if we love our forests so much, why are we taxing them? Private property rights for for-profit forest-owned businesses should be equally protected under liability laws that make them competitive with their most significant competitor, State of New York, Forest Preserve, private NGOs, New York City, DEP. What do I mean by that? Say you're a private landowner. You own 100 acres. And you want to open – we get this all the time, the Catskill Forest Association. Someone wants to have an educational center, right? Or they want to have a place where someone can hike on their property. Once you put it to for-profit, you're now – open to liability. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, who are you competing against? The state of New York, who basically offers the same service for free, and they don't have the liability. That's not fair. So I think if that changed, it would be different. And like Mohonk Preserve, they're a nonprofit. I don't know if their liability is the same for people who rock climb there as it would be for just, you know, John McNaught, who wants to offer his 100 acres out for hiking. Those are questions that should be answered by a lawyer better than me. But I just don't feel like it's on an equal playing field. It disincentivizes landowners to make a living from their land and preserve their property. So that's an example. You also have the New York City DEP, who offers recreation. So that's a competition. Leasing of hunting rights could be encouraged to incentivize habitat improvement. An example, Texas. One of those privately owned states has one of the healthiest deer herds in the U.S. How do we know it's healthy? How would we define that? We would define it as buck to doe ratio. You know, here it's like 3 to 1, 3 does for every 1 buck, which is really bad. There it's like 1.5 to 1 or something. It's something really good. At least it was the last time I looked at it. The reason why is Texas Parks and Wildlife, as Ruben Cantu said at the Growing Deer Debate back in 2015, they work with landowners. He says they're the ones who control access. They really own the habitat. Why wouldn't we work with them? You know, it'd be like working with ranchers and their pasture. We're going to work with the person who owns it. So they incentivize these landowners, these ranchers, to provide good habitat. The ranchers, in turn, why do they do it? They make money off big bucks. You know, hey, when the cows aren't bringing home the bacon, the deer are making money for them. Yeah, they make some money off of their deer. But you know what? They get compensated for all the hard work it takes to cut the right tree and leave the right one. I don't think that's so bad.
Right.
You know? It's not perfect, but hey. Most of the forest remains privately owned. This is an asset, not a liability. I think a lot of times you look at maps and people will paint this picture of private land as white and the state-owned land as green. And it looks like to the person who just looked at it for the first time, like those are vulnerable areas. No, I see it differently. These are areas of opportunity. Private land has tremendous opportunity as long as it's giving an equal playing field. So just to recap, I think that the progressive conservation movement, Theodore Roosevelt, may have had its place, but they really declared war on their biggest villain, which was market hunting, making themselves the biggest hero. Mm-hmm. And in some part, that's true. But I think the primary stressor was habitat loss or farms. And what brought back wildlife was really farm abandonment. And the secondary stressor was market hunting only where lack of property rights occurred. And that's my story.
It's a good story.
I don't know.
No, I.
It's a story.
I like it.
But
I mean, there's a lot of more things to explore. There's other species, of course, that stress more under certain conditions than others, and you can poke holes here and there. But
absolutely,
that's any story, right?
Absolutely. But yeah, I just see it as a lost opportunity. That's all. Incentives matter. People need incentives to do things. But that's all I got. And yeah, you got anything?
Next week, Gary Mead's going to be on a week early, so he'll be on the second Wednesday next week.
All right. Take care. Have a good night.
Good night.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long-forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river